things from memory. I was at a lecture picnic a couple of weekends ago, and the surrounding of people were very much taken, taken to drugs and alcohol and things that are very much unnourishing for any human being, from my own experience. When it's, you know, when it's that level, I found it very difficult for a period of time. And I went for a lovely 2 to 3 hour walk with nature, and felt an amazing connection and liberation from that, I suppose. And the lines I wrote were so much infinite beauty in nature. So much wrong with conforming habitual society human behavior. How does one deal with it? Does one feel the sadness? Or does one be cardioprotective, protect your heart? And when you are being cardioprotective, are you just numbing your mind to what you see? Feeling the emotions going into your mind. Yeah, so that was kind of the essence of the walk, the excursion. And it's kind of, I read a quotation the other day which said, most people listen to society, the wise man listens to the mountains.
Counteraction to all the Christian main course, Indian indigestion. Take Judas, swallow the tablets with pride, and see your insides out. Ganesh, elephant god, music maker. We need more than your ears now. We'd be closer to sanctity with your multiple deities. Release the Mahabharata 9, injustice of the peace. Meanwhile, back at the branch of the tree, the thing with the mouth, the poor mouth, the fucking all the time mouth, was reporting back to Drumcondra. I fucking followed him, boss, all the way through mist and fucking rain into the car park. I was able to see him swapping bags like a cokehead. I nailed the bollocks up the stairs into Hart's lair. Farm gate, they call it. I wouldn't shit on it. He's that shifting seats. He's a fucker to follow, boss. You should have seen me fitting in with the Minahan shots on the wall. I made sure he wouldn't pick me out of a crowd. Boss, wake up, boss. Listen to it, boss. You wanted this fella stopped, a wee dirty dancing number. I know you don't go in for loose ends. You wanted his habits clocked. He was on the job. Oh, I could tell by the sight in his eyes. David Mack, that fucker who wouldn't chew garlic if his nan was dying for it. I heard him ask if Mac Williams had made it across the border from the island. I only know one island, boss, and we know what sort of fuckers come out of there. He was definitely onto something, boss, otherwise he'd never have sat there under all the shite stuff on the wall. I went in the jacks, kicked the fucking combination open. I heard him whispering it to himself, something about the McCarthy, boss. There's some sort of raid coming. I'm sure he's onto it. The McCarthys and the Lenhens. Because I had him going on about Brian. For the life of Brian, boss, I claim him now before he's settled and sure. He didn't even finish his coffee and he had a computer, one of those laptops you use for the children, boss, after your suspended sentence. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Paul. That was great. And next, Afrik, please. Afrik, please.
Thank you. This one's called Fish. Your bony spine protrudes, thin forward, keeping you upright as you patrol around me, grounded in sand. Shoulder high in salt. You cross your arms, stare back, lean into a rock. Your spiny rays, stiff, segmented, lock into a crevice. You smile, shake loose, flash your tail, an asymmetrical lobe. Lunate, you might say. Swim stroke past me while I stand rigid. Your hands explore for vents. Desire thickens. There is an evolutionary line, an arch perhaps, through which we travel, buoyant as fish, ascending or descending with the current. You drown me, then feed me with air, fingers seeking. I am speechless.
Confusion. If I steal your mind, I could replace it with mine. Wrong body, right thought. I wonder, would it take long to adapt, to fit, to feel your skin as mine? If I steal your mind, would your body realize that a snatch has taken place? You would lose a few things, like weight, and gain a few others, like an occasional hard cock. If I steer your mind, would you wake uncertain, listening to an unfamiliar breath? Would your thoughts learn to fit your new body with mine? If I steer your mind, I may just steer your body too, for continuity.
And next we have Rosamund.
This is titled Tattoo Head. It's under your skin, it's hours of pain, decorated of tribal, reformed, remerged, redone, recreated. How many heads have turned? How many have reacted? When was the last time you were questioned for what it stood for, instead of its effect it has on unknowing eyes? Your body is your canvas, stretched and shriveled with time. What expression is left? A frown or a smile? Or do you have regrets, or feel it's worthwhile? This mask of yours, does it protect you from the world, or the world from you? I cannot finish with undertones like this. I feel your courage and honor you for doing what you wish.
Thanks very much. And now we have Michael Francis O'Donnell, I believe.
Hello. He turned his eye which down the guard upon the gentle mental bard, and said in tones abrupt to stare, "Why, Brady, dost thou light a hair?" I bade hence the bard obeyed, and turning from his own sweet maid, the aged knight so real line, that both his lady shall dine. I was kissing a young lady in Canterbury Cathedral only last week, and I said, "Are you familiar," I said, "with the Red Deer, the Canterbury?" "No, I never heard of him," she said, but I said, "I'll tell you a story about him. The Red Deer of Canterbury, Hewlett Johnson, invited Mahatma Gandhi in the 30s, who was known then as a terrorist, an Indian terrorist, like, you know, over to the cathedral. He sent a limousine, which in England, of course, is known as a Rolls Royce, down to Canterbury Station to pick up Gandhi. So he picks up Gandhi. Well, I mean, the car picks him up anyway, and he's waiting anyway for the East song. And when they're walking up the door, like, out comes Gandhi with his personal goat and the spinning wheel, and into the East song. Can you imagine that? I said, there was this Scot, you see. There was a professor of English somewhere in the Canterbury Cathedral, University, and he was trying to do the Red Dean all the time. So the Red Dean went to China in about 1951-52, and he discovered that the Americans were using chemical warfare on the Koreans, and he went to the pulpit and he damned them for it, like, you know. Canterbury, who was Canterbury at the time, Fisher, Lord Fisher, raised a motion in the House of Lords saying, "This turbulent speech has to go, he's got to go, this is outrageous, you know, this carry on, you know." And he wrote to Churchill and said, "Get rid of him, tell the Queen of whoever was there at the time, get rid of him." Anyway, Churchill wrote back and he said, "I perused all the articles of English, you know, the Church of England, and I said, 16th century, and I can find no weapons to chemical warfare."
And now we have somebody here we haven't seen for a long time. I forget his name. I think it was Alan Chitley.
No, I have something produced out of my pocket. This is a very short poem in my favourite form, a sonnet, was an extended sonnet of 16 lines rather than 14, because I only composed it while I was walking and whatever. It's called Sordi MacLean, Sordi MacLean, the great Scottish Gaelic poet, has a poem called On Yeats's Grave. And I had the good fortune to be just passing by Yeats's grave in Sligo a couple of weeks ago, and I had pure good fortune to be in South of France near Yeats's grave recently, so I call this Yeats's Graves. Okay, Yeats's Graves. William Butler Yeats, he had sex after his death, for we knew that he got laid in his grave. Not once but twice, the latter upon the heath of Drumcliff Churchyard, where he is safe, except for tourists, scholars, and those hordes of groupies from the summer school. But before that, buried along the board of the Mediterranean, where it was then the rule, on the shore of that great lake, the pauper would lie down with the noble, the robber, in his case, he slept with dukes, barons, nobbers, and in one case, a witless grocer's daughter. But when his favourite bones were disinterred, and wraith-like femurs did thus mix and mash, we cannot argue, preach, insist, or else infer that Yeats's bones from top to toe did entirely match. In Drumcliff Churchyard, not all there meets the eye, as a tombstone says, arseman passed by.